Should people have to check boxes on gender boxes, on bureaucratic forms? What about identification documents like driver's licenses or birth certificates? Should there be signs for male and females on bathrooms? These are just a few of the questions we will explore with a guest who argues that we would be better off if society had fewer sex classification policies. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Do you think we need gender designations? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Heath Fogg Davis, an associate professor of political science at Temple University in Philadelphia and an appointed member of Philadelphia's Mayoral Commission on LGBT Affairs. He previously taught as an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Good morning, and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So you believe that we would be better off in a society with, quote, dramatically fewer sex classification policies. Before we dig into your argument, walk us through the number and the range of sex classification policies in our individual and social lives. How many and how far reaching are these classification policies?
Yeah, well, I think they're just about everywhere that you look, really. And so everything to sort of like the obvious ones that have to do with public restrooms, sex-segregated sports, sex-segregated colleges and other institutions of education, all the bureaucratic forms that you sort of referenced in the beginning, many job applications, mortgage applications, a lot of the paperwork that we're asked to complete has with it these sex boxes that we're asked to check, and sometimes we're forced to do it. When you apply for college, for example, if you're doing something, doing the application online, often you have to check a gender box in order to move on to the next screen. So it's really ubiquitous. And what I try to do in the book is to advocate that we actually should stop and consider the range of gender, sort of gender questions that we ask in our society.
Yeah. Well, why should we? What are the problems associated with this?
Yeah, there's a sort of two ways of looking at this, I think. And one is that that a lot of these sex classification policies pose real obstacles for people who are transgender, intersex, maybe gender nonconforming in some kind of way. And then it's also true, I think, and I try to make this argument too, that even for people who are not in those categories, that don't identify in those ways, often when sex is invoked in a policy, there's not a clear explanation about why the business or organization is asking us to do this. And if you take the restroom example, for example, yes, it's an issue for trans and gender nonconforming people, but it's also an issue for parents who have children out in the public sphere, anyone who's a caretaker of somebody of a different sex who's trying to use a public restroom. That poses an obstacle as well. So in a lot of these cases, invoking sex is extraneous and it doesn't serve a clear purpose.
Yeah. Using the bathroom example, though, what's wrong with that? The family bathroom or the gender-neutral bathroom? Isn't that how a lot of businesses are trying to comply with that?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think that's an example of a reform that is progressive, and I think moves in the right direction, but doesn't go far enough. In the first place, we don't have a consistent sort of application of that third option in the public sphere. And any time when you kind of create a third option, you're leaving intact the existing sex binary. And I really try to make the point in the book that that's the source of gender identity discrimination. That instituting the sex binary in different policies is really the source of that kind of discrimination. So adding a third public restroom, for example, it sort of stigmatizes people who may not feel comfortable or who are not welcomed into traditionally sex-segregated bathrooms by telling them to go to a third option. That third option is usually just one single-user bathroom, so there's sort of an issue about how long people have to wait to use a public restroom. And this brings me to another point that I raise in the book, which is that these kinds of sex-segregated public restrooms also create traditional forms of sexism where women and girls have to wait longer in line to use public restrooms in crowded venues. And so you can just see the difference in kind of like the periods of waiting time.
Hear, hear. But a lot of people would also, though, say, well, the women and the girls have privacy in their sex segregated bathroom and may not want to share a bathroom with men and boys.
Yes, and I think that's the number one concern and objection that people have to my argument. And I think that it's the issue of privacy and safety. Those two things are typically the ones that get raised. And I think they're both valid. Particularly, I address the privacy issue. I think that that's a legitimate concern, and it's a legitimate policy goal for a business or organization to have when constructing their public restrooms. But there's an architectural solution to this that is gender neutral, which is I think we should build public restrooms very differently. Here in Philadelphia and in some restaurants in Manhattan, there are like a row or a circle of single-user toilet stalls with floor-to-ceiling partitions that give people adequate privacy. So what we're really talking about is a certain degree of physical seclusion from other people, and I think everybody can relate to that. That's an important thing. But you can accomplish that without having sex segregation in public restrooms. So you just create privacy by giving people individual stalls. And then, like here in Philadelphia, you'll have like a common area in the middle of sinks and mirrors where, you know, people can wash their hands and whatever. And it's interesting because businesses have really done this out of a space concern. So it's a way of using tight space in a more efficient way. But it actually has this this ripple effect, I think, that's really positive. And a lot of people don't even notice that it's a gender-neutral restroom.
Yeah, and you would advocate the same type of situation for locker rooms?
I would, and that's it's all about kind of creating enough physical seclusion to give individuals adequate privacy. So the assumption that we're working under right now in terms of locker rooms, for example, is that the reason that we don't want to have men and women in the same locker room is because we don't want to see members of the opposite sex naked, but that assumes a lot about sexual desire and that everybody's heterosexual. So it falls apart in a lot of dimensions, but I think that the core issue is that we should build both bathrooms and locker rooms very differently than we do right now, so that you give individual people the kind of like physical seclusion that they need and want without using sex as a proxy for that kind of privacy and safety.
We are talking with Heath Fogg Davis, author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? And we are talking with him about his case that we should do away with many of these sex-segregated bathrooms, locker rooms, sex classification policies. Why should we say that we're male or female when we fill out a job application or an application for a driver's license? Why does gender matter? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's take a call. Let's go to Kayla in Racine first. Hi, Kayla.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good.
So basically, what I called in about is I'm intersex and also transgender. And in New Jersey, it's very difficult to get your birth sex changed to the sex that you identify with on your birth certificate. They require laws that... the law requires that you undergo surgery to do that. And it's very frustrating because a lot of transgender people don't want to do the surgery for one reason or the other, bottom surgery. And the law makes it impossible for a person to do that. And basically, I live on the border of Wisconsin and Illinois, and I have to go back to New Jersey to have this change. And it makes my life frustrating in so many other areas.
Kayla, I'm sorry to interrupt, Kayla, but your connection is a little fuzzy. I want to make sure I understood. You have a sex designation on your birth certificate that is different than what you identify as?
Correct. I was born and... what the doctor put on my birth certificate is the male designation. And it turned out later on in life, when I was a teenager, it was found that I have an intersex condition. So I have two X chromosomes and one Y chromosome. And it's called Klinefelter syndrome. And I also happen to be transgender, so I would prefer to live as a female. Mm-hmm. And to change that sex designation on my birth certificate, you have to undergo surgery. And this idea that this person is putting forward is amazing and wonderful, in my eyes at least, because it allows, it would do away with all of that. I wouldn't have to worry about any of these things on any of my public documents or anything, and I wouldn't have to worry about a gender designation, and that would be incredible.
Yeah, so, and Kayla, it might be easy for someone who doesn't have to worry about that to ask, but why is it important for you to have the proper sex designation on your birth certificate?
Well, if I have the proper sex designation on my birth certificate, then I can get my other public documents, changed over to that correct gender. Say I was pulled over by a police officer and I look female, all my social cues, the way I look, I'm passing, but they get my license and they refer to me as female until they see my driver's license. And then they start referring to me as a male. Uh-huh. Or I go to the hospital, and the doctors all and nurses and the admittance all start referring to me as male in front of other people. It creates a very distressing environment, and a lot of cisgender people that are comfortable with the sex that they're born as versus the gender that they, a person born female is comfortable with their femininity and they're comfortable with being female or vice versa. These aren't issues that they would have to deal with. And most people in society just don't know how to respond or deal with issues like this. And this is something that as a transgender person, we deal with on a regular basis.
Thank you very much, Kayla, for sharing your story. And opening our eyes to something. So Heath, what's your reaction to Kayla's story?
Yeah, I'm really grateful for Kayla to share her story. I think it raises this issue about the relevance in particular situations of sex designations. And when you think about, like, what's the purpose, what's the, you know, for driver's licenses, passports, birth certificates, it's really the government does have a legitimate reason for keeping track of our personal identities, which is to say that to verify that you are who you say you are in situations where the potential for personal identity fraud is high and the consequences are serious. But the government doesn't have a legitimate reason to keep track of our sex identities. And what we're learning as a society right now, as far as we're talking about intersex identities, trans identities, is that number one, sex is not necessarily dyadic for everybody. The sex binary is true in the aggregate, but for individuals, it's not always. That we're understanding with trans identities that sex is actually a mutable or changeable characteristic. And so, again, for the majority of cisgender people, non-trans people, yes, there can be a correspondence, and it's hard to sort of wrap your mind around why this would be problematic. But for the minority of us who change our sex identities from what we were designated at birth, these policies pose real obstacles. And I think the example of getting pulled over by the police, you know, this is, you know, many of us for a traffic violation, speeding or whatever, can find ourselves in that situation. And then I think, as Kayla's pointing out, for most people, I don't think that police officers are necessarily looking at gender markers. So again, it's sort of, putting trans people and people who look gender nonconforming in a difficult position where the police officer in that particular situation then has a lot of power to mistreat that individual, whether it be in terms of using the wrong gender pronoun or other forms of harassment. And I think that that's a real, real concern.
So should we remove gender markers from driver's licenses or birth certificates or passports? Should we do away with many of the sex classification policies that exist right now? Our guest is making the case for doing that, and we wonder what you think. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Heath Fogg Davis is the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So, do you think that we should have to check boxes, the M and F boxes, on bureaucratic forms? Should we be designated a male or female on our birth certificates or our driver's licenses or other identification documents? Do you think that there ought to be separate male and female bathrooms? We are talking with a guest who is making the case that we should do away with this these sex classification policies and these sex-segregated bathrooms, locker rooms, sports, education. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Heath Fogg Davis is the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? He is an associate professor of political science at Temple University in Philadelphia. He is on the Philadelphia's Mayoral Commission on LGBT Affairs. He previously taught as an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. And we have lots of callers, but I wanted, Heath, to talk with you, too, on how these sex classification policies have affected you specifically. You talked about you are transgender. You're a transgender male.
Mm-hmm. yes. So they've impacted me in some interesting ways, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book where I share a little bit of my own story. I didn't transition until pretty late in life, so at the age of 38. So I'd had lots of years of experience growing up as a gender nonconforming kid, and then sort of a more masculine presenting woman at different points in my life. And I would say that this created a lot of difficulty for me, and I think a lot of other people can relate to this, that getting sort of harassed in women's restrooms, and was sort of a constant thing, being questioned, you're not in the right place. And this, I think, to other people who don't go through that, sort of consistently, that difficulty can seem like not a big deal, but it really is. It weighs on your spirit, and it's a very difficult thing to manage. So, interestingly enough, now I'm a pretty gender conforming man, and I don't get harassed when I use public restrooms that are sex segregated. I use the men's room, obviously, now. And so this raises just a quick point that I want to make, is that when we talk about transgender discrimination, we have to break it down even more. So this is something that is more specifically about gender identity discrimination, and it's something that impacts people who don't necessarily identify as trans. And then there are some trans people, such as myself, who don't encounter a lot of discrimination in the public sphere because we don't appear to be transgender. So I think getting more specific about what kind of discrimination we're talking about here is really important.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. As I mentioned, we have very busy lines. Christian in Hayward is with us. Hi, Christian.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I kind of disagree with what your guest is saying for a couple of reasons. I wouldn't say that I'm a prejudiced person at all, but there have been some experiences that I've had that were I thought the gender-conforming issue didn't belong in that setting. For example, I went to the hospital about 3 weeks ago with my wife and son. He had a checkup. And, we're filling out the standard issue, little paperwork stuff, and right at the top there underneath his name, they had approximately, I would say, about 15 to 20 different options for how you self-identify. And something like that just really blew my mind, because as a place of science, which a hospital should be, there's really only two, you either got an X or you got a Y. And that,
Well, we just heard from a caller who had more than that, Christian. But why did it blow your mind? I mean, was that a big problem for you?
Not particularly. It just really surprised me because, like I said, it's a place of science, not opinion.
Yeah. Well, what about what Christian's saying, Heath? He says the male and female boxes, that's science in a hospital. A hospital doesn't have to ask, are you cisgender? Are you this? Are you that?
Yeah. And I actually agree with Christian on the point about having, more options, more boxes to check. I think we maybe are in agreement there that I don't think that that's the right way to proceed. I do think that when it comes to providing health care, the main goal is to be able to get good information from that individual patient so that health care provider can give the best health care to that individual. So that means asking relevant questions. So sometimes, going to the hospital, going to the doctor, you know, sex-based characteristics will be relevant, and sometimes they won't. So if I break my arm and I end up in an emergency room, how relevant is it that I am a transgender man? Whereas if we're talking about reproductive organs, then that's a different case, and that varies. So the problem is using any kind of sex-based designation as a proxy for body parts, for chromosomes. We just, as you mentioned, heard from Kayla, there are people who are intersex, so it's not a matter of male or female or clear-cut science. There's a lot more variation when it comes to chromosomes, when it comes to physiological characteristics, than we as a society really acknowledge. And that, I will just add to that, another point of agreement I think I have with Christian is that when it comes to science, yes, there's statistical data on sex-related characteristics that's important and valuable. So I think that I'm not advocating that the medical community get rid of those markers altogether. But when it comes to filling out paperwork, your goal is slightly different. You're really trying to aim to give the best care to that individual. So you want them to be comfortable. So instead of having 15 to 20 categories, I would advocate for asking a better question. So if it's a question about, you know, do you have a prostate? If that's really what we're talking about.
Carl in Black River Falls has a related point. Hi, Carl.
Hi. The guy just kind of touched on what I was thinking. When you have medicines dispensed, certain medicines are for women and certain are for men. And you have to know who's who when you dispense, say, Viagra. You don't give women Viagra unless they've developed the one for Viagra yet. When you have an operation, you don't remove ovaries from a man.
Yeah.
You need to know whether it's a male or female. If you are incarcerated, you don't want to be a woman in a men's facility or a man in a woman's facility. There have to be designations, and people should be able to accept that.
All right. What about that, Heath?
Yeah, I mean, the incarceration issue that you brought up. So I think the argument that I'm making in the book is transportable to all of these different case studies. So when it comes to jails and prisons, then we have to ask, what are the legitimate policy goals at stake here? And one of them has to do with safety and protecting people against sexual violence. But there are other things as well. And then I think it's up to us as a society to think about how useful is sex classification as a proxy for getting to those goals. And in a lot of cases, I think that we can get to those goals in a different way. So one initial thought about jails and prisons is that we could build those differently as well. So there's a lot that's wrong with those institutions right now. And we know that sex segregation does not protect people from rape in particular and other forms of sexual violence when they're incarcerated. So that's a big, big myth that I would say we need to kind of dispel and move on to the real question about how do we protect people who are incarcerated better than we do right now. And then just quickly on the medical issue about pharmaceuticals and surgeries. So I think that there are issues of just traditional sexism that are existing. We're finding out now that a lot of the drug trials are just, you know, have been tested out on men, and there are issues about how transferable that information is to women. And as far as surgeries go, I mean, again, I think it's about the particular patient, you know, and again, we can say in the aggregate that maybe, you know, that sex-based characteristics are consistent with somebody's sex identity and how they present, but that's not always the case. And you don't want to have a blanket policy that ends up discriminating against a minority of people.
Barry emailed, and wonders if you believe that issues like Title IX and gender minority status slash protections should be eliminated. For example, Title IX's whole premise is based on gender.
Yeah. I don't think that Title IX should be eliminated. And whenever I talk about the argument in the book, I'm inevitably asked the question, well, are there some cases where you think that we should use sex and gender? And I think the two cases that examples that I talk about, one is sex-based affirmative action. So for getting to goals of gender equity, whether it be the number of sports teams in a school, a college, you have to ask about gender in order to have an accounting of it to sort of meet goals. So I think that that's a legitimate use of sex classification. That said, I think that when we're doing that kind of accounting to get to that legitimate goal, we have to do a better job of defining what we mean by maleness and femaleness in a particular setting. And that sounds like, I think for a lot of people, like a crazy thing to be asking about, because we all know what sex is, what gender is, but as we've been talking in our conversation here today, we know that it's more complicated. So I'm a big fan of whenever a business or an organization invokes sex in a bureaucratic way, that they should really explain their working definition of that term.
Yeah. Well, what about the case you make about sex-segregated sports?
Yeah. I think sports is the most complicated venue, and it's the last case study that I address in the book, because I kind of go from what I think is the most straightforward to the most complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to sports, the legitimate policy goal is fair play. But that's a very vague kind of concept. So I think that, again, we need to get more specific here. Sometimes it's about a kind of paternalism and protecting girls and women from, whether it's like, from fighting and checking in ice hockey. So I'm thinking back to my time in Wisconsin, and I played hockey there, and I still play hockey. So we have to get more specific about sort of what we're talking about. I think the level of play makes a big difference also. So if we're talking about recreational sports for kids or for adults versus elite competition, I think that there are different goals there, and it's really for sports organizations and authorities to really look at how they can better meet their legitimate goals through invoking gender.
Yeah. Another area you consider for reform is single-sex colleges. What concerns you there?
Yeah. Again, I think that I am a big supporter of the feminist goals of a lot of, in particular, private women's colleges. There are just, I think, three private men's colleges that exist today, so the vast majority of them are women's colleges. I think the history is important, and the goals of gender equity when it comes to higher education, when it comes to, we know from the social science data that having at women's colleges, there are more leadership opportunities for women and more likelihood to speak up in classes, and there are a lot of good things to be said there. I think that I would like to see those colleges retain their feminist mission and their goals, but open their admissions to everybody, regardless of gender, but also perhaps on their application forms, be very clear about their goals and ask, whether it's through like a short essay or some kind of question, for men who want to go to those colleges to understand what they're applying to.
We will take more of your calls in just a moment. We are talking with Heath Fogg Davis. He is the author of Beyond Trans: Does Gender Matter? And we wonder if you think gender matters. Does it matter? Should we have to check off the male or female box on applications? Or should it be on our driver's license? Should it be on our birth certificates? Our guest is making the case that it doesn't need to be there. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Heath Fogg Davis about a very thought-provoking topic. He is the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? And he thinks we ought to do away with a lot of the sex segregation that we have going on in society today, that we would be better off if we had fewer sex classification policies, that we didn't have to check the gender boxes on forms or driver's licenses. And we're wondering what you think and what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's go next to Natalie in Madison. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to talk about my child, who is 6 and a half now, and identified as both a male and female, born male, identified as both a male and female through preschool, and that was completely fine. His teachers, his classmates, everyone was very supportive of that. And he has two names, and I use the pronoun he because that's what he wants right now. And then he went to elementary school and kindergarten this year, and instead of just having two bathrooms in the classroom in preschool for all the children, now he had to go in the boys' bathroom or the girls' bathroom and was really forbidden to go in the girls' bathroom. He presents more male. And it kind of broke him a little bit. He decided about a quarter of the way through school that he came home one day and he said he gave up Sally, which was his female name. His teacher was great about it. I think everything except for the structural part of the bathrooms being separated and having to choose based on how the building that is set up, he would have been much better off. And he has told us that he is only a boy now, and he doesn't want to talk about it because it makes him too sad. And when he told us he gave up Sally, it really just broke our hearts. And you could see the sadness in his face. And he still loves to wear rainbows and sparkles and purple and have long hair. But that structure that was placed on him was really hard for him.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Heath, what's your reaction?
That's heartbreaking to hear, and it reminds me, we've had a very important court case in the Seventh Circuit Court, and it's Kenosha, so it's in your region over there. A court decision that this was a high school student, I think 17 years old. The ruling was in favor of the student being able to use the sex segregated bathroom in their school that corresponded to their own understanding of their own sex identity. And that's the kind of reform. It's important, but again, it doesn't go far enough because, and I think you sort of, Natalie, sort of touching on this, I mean, there are kids and people who identify as non-binary as well. So there's that, it doesn't solve the issue, the problem for them. So I think that it's an architectural issue. And I think that I was speaking to some architects recently. I mean, there are some people out there who are thinking creatively about this, and there are buildings that are getting built differently. But unfortunately, when it comes to restroom construction, it's there's a lot of room for improvement in the public sphere, and it's not a big priority for a lot of places, schools included, when it comes to construction. But I think that there are a lot of reasons to take that particular issue more seriously and think about doing things differently. I wrote an op-ed about this issue for schools and the bathrooms for CNN recently, where I think there's also like the ripple effects that sex-segregated bathrooms and schools are not really safe places for a lot of kids, and they tend to be places where kids get bullied for a lot of different reasons. So I think that there are like trans-specific reasons to rethink these policies, but there's also universal benefits that can go far beyond those of us who identify as trans or intersex.
Well, and let's talk a little bit more about that. And it's mm-hmm. heartbreaking for Natalie's child, who's very sad that Sally he gave up Sally. But how would having the gender neutral bathroom make it better for everybody?
Yeah, in a lot of different ways. So, I mean, by de-emphasizing sex classification in that particular venue, I think that I mentioned a few of the benefits before. Anybody who's gender nonconforming to any degree. There's that issue. There's the inequality issue about urinals versus toilet stalls and the wait times. There's a caretaking issue. I have a daughter who's like 20 months old, and I have to violate the sex segregation policy when I go and change her diaper. And so it falls apart in so many different ways. And I think that we can do things a lot better. So while we're at it, one of the great things that Obama did in the waning days of his presidency was to ensure that there were diaper changing tables installed in all men's rooms in federal buildings. So there's like a lot of ways that we could be doing a much better job with public restrooms in general.
Yeah. Well, we have, let's go back to the phones. Dennis in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. My question is, with all these different gender identities going around and keep popping up everywhere, isn't anyone afraid of the effect of it being the government or anyone going and just changing everything to co-ed, males, females, everyone uses the same bathrooms, the same locker rooms, the same everything, and just take gender completely out of the mix?
Well, that's what you're arguing for, Heath, isn't it?
It is. And I think, right now we have this social and legal presumption that gender does matter most of the time and in all of these places. And what I'm pushing for is to flip that on its head and presume that gender doesn't matter except in certain cases where we think it does matter. And then in those cases, we have to explain why it matters and how. So again, it comes back to this basic question about what do we even mean by sex? What do we mean by gender? The Supreme Court, in all of its sex ruling cases, sex discrimination, uses these terms interchangeably, and academics have a delineation between sex and gender. So there's it's something that we think we understand and we think we know it when we see it. But when we really start to ask some questions, we see that things sort of fall apart and we don't know exactly what we think we knew.
Let's go to Billy now in Greene County. Hi, Billy.
Hey, good morning. I guess the point that I had to make was I lived over in Europe for a while, in Austria in particular, and speaking about the locker room thing, when you were going to go to the swimming pool or you're going to go into a locker room situation, it was one common area. So the first time that I walked in there being American, I walked in, I looked down the row, and there were two moms, changing their kids. And I kind of took a look, and I went back out to make sure I wasn't in the wrong one. I asked, and they said, nope, sure enough, everybody shares the same one, and then they have little individual like stalls in there where you could go in if you wanted some privacy to change. But, you know, the people over there didn't have any problem with it. It was fine. It was just the way it was. And my thought is, you know, right away, if it got changed, you know, there might be some, you know, people would probably say, well, I don't know if I like this, isn't a good idea. But I think over time, once people got used to it, it probably wouldn't be that big of a deal.
So is Europe already doing some of this, Heath?
Yes. Yes, they are. And I'm really glad that Billy brought that example. And I've heard a lot of anecdotal, you know, similar stories. And it really goes to this important point that what we're talking about here is really social custom and cultural custom. There's nothing inherent, like there's no like objective reason why we have to have sex segregation in the places that we have it. And Billy pointing out that Austria, I think he was talking about, does things very differently. And you can see as an American going into that environment that it's not a big deal for people. It tells us that, you know, we have our own cultural hang-ups here. And it also indicates that over time we could get used to doing things differently. And I think that there would be, if we moved in the direction of getting rid of a lot of these sex classification policies, we probably would see some initial rumblings about this is strange. And in fact, we're seeing that even now as we're talking more about these issues. But over time, I think there's a lot of reason to think that we would get used to it and it wouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah. Of course, though, earlier this year, the Trump administration decide to repeal the guidelines put in place by President Obama concerning transgender students' bathroom access. Are you hopeful that we will see the changes you'd like anytime soon?
Yeah, I wrote this book thinking we would have a different administration. So I'm not, you know, it's clear that the Trump administration is not a friend to the LGBT community through a lot of its actions. However, the court decision in the Seventh Circuit that happened at the end of May that we talked about earlier gives me hope, so that there's pushback from courts. And I think that there's a real opportunity for individuals within organizations and businesses to make these changes. So we can talk about policy on the level of, like, how are we going to interpret Title IX, but there's also administrative policies that is really within the control of managers and, you know, people running businesses can make some different decisions about how they construct bathrooms, for example. So I mentioned the Philadelphia example of having gender-neutral, bathrooms. So that's a decision that an individual business made. And I think that there's an opportunity for individuals who want to move forward in these ways to make some really high-impact changes that don't require an act of Congress, but they actually just be done by individuals.
Thank you so much for being with us. Heath Fogg Davis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? He is a former professor of political science at UW-Madison. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Michelle Johnson for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Kerr-Dean. This is the Ideas Network.